Celebration. And this is kind of, apart from the final, guys, this is our last lecture. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that excellent? Isn't that super? Oh, and in other news, as far as I know, we have one person who wants to do Exploration 2 this semester, so we're not running it. We're doing the Linux course. And the other person who was going to do it said that he would choose between the Linux course and the Exploration course, and if we ran the Linux course, then he was going to do that over the Exploration course. So, yes!
Did Brian get hold of you?
Brian emailed me about something. There was an application form. I haven't opened it yet.
Okay, because I know he wanted to do Exploration 2.
That's two of you. Do you have any idea how much work there is in modifying that course? I'm not putting my hand up. I need sighted help I don't have to modify packet tracer labs I can't do into curriculum that hasn't been written. And given the level of support I get from the academy, keep dreaming, people, I'm not doing it. This is 2012's resolution. Kerry will not put his hand up for stupid, inachievable things. I'm terribly sorry.
Shall we change channels?
Why not? For those who seriously want to go on with Exploration 2, 3, and 4, BitTorrent is your friend. Get a book.
Yeah, I was about to ask. I assume you could technically study a CCNA manual and... Yeah.
You could. In fact, it is a perfectly legitimate way of taking the exams to take them from the books rather than take them from this curriculum. You don't get the half-price discount voucher, which upsets some people, but it is a perfectly acceptable way of doing it. If I get a reasonable amount of support and some volunteers that can actually do something, this is about as likely as 2012 end-of-day prophecies we may see an Exploration 2 course.
And we do have access to the Flash curriculum for the other courses, right? To do it on our own?
In saying that, guys, you should really meet our volunteers and understand who we get into the academy. We have a girl that apparently gets high honors in her exams, but she cannot, write a full sentence. Literally, cannot. I don't know what's wrong with her. Very nice girl, but really, really useless.
Why does this lab say I need two computers?
Oh, okay.
Yes, this was a question that was leveled at me. So do I really need two computers?
No, it wasn't that. It was, I can't get this computer to work. The computer wasn't even on and she hadn't done anything with it.
Oh, I had suppressed.
Are these university students? Or?
Yes!
What are they taking as their major?
Drugs.
CIS information, business information systems. They're going to be project managers.
Oh,
these are our future leaders.
Dear God, help us.
Yeah, this girl is fucking 220 fries short of a Happy Meal.
All we need is her to be running some major telecommunications company. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think she's the next future president for Charter. Okay.
Lucky you, Kevin.
All right, I'm going to put this on AutoVox, and we shall try and have a review lecture. If it breaks, you keep both pieces. So I'll just go and do that. This is our hopefully second last lecture. I will be writing up the exam diagram descriptions. And then you guys get to have a shot at it next week, and we hope they haven't snuck in and changed all the forms on us. Won't that be fun? Has anybody tried the practice final apart from John, who managed to get 88.1% even though the descriptions didn't match? So, it's doable.
Not yet. That's on my plate for this weekend, probably.
Yeah, not yet.
Ugh, this appears to be constantly keyed. Nasty. Let's have a look.
Just curious, did anyone else notice how Module 11 sort of positioned itself in the beginning about being this all-encompassing summary, review, putting it all together kind of thing, but wasn't?
That's sort of true, actually.
Okay. Oh, okay, I've got to drop the sensitivity a bit lower. Yeah, that was it was awesome, wasn't it? It was this will be the sum-up module, and then it, said about 300 different new things and didn't go back over anything. It was awesome.
No, but it did iOS, so there you go.
Okie dokie. Oh, that's keying up. Excellent. All right. No, seriously, if you want to do exploration too, put pressure on my boss and see if he can get me some resources. That's your best bet at even getting it looked at. I'm not going anywhere near it without resources. I can't even read the labs. So, yeah, not happening. And he is i.murray at curtin.edu.au. There you go. And anybody who wants it in can harass me, and I'll give it to them. And we can give him a hard time. Okie dokie. Welcome to the revision lecture for Exploration 1, which is meant to review all of the stuff that you guys need to know for the final, and hopefully not miss anything. Although missing things will probably be inevitable because I don't have a copy of the final in front of me, and that would be rather unfair if I did, because you guys would get a bit of an advantage, which would not be so cool. Does anybody have any general questions or things that they are confused about before I launch into a whizzing review of modules 1 through 11?
So when we do the final next week, are we all doing it sort of at once? Is that what happens, or how does that work?
That's the theory. We're all rocking onto Ventrilo, and we're all going to do the final at once. And that way we're going to get it all out of the way in one fell swoop. And you will all have done it by the end of the lecture time, luckily. Unless you're a really slow final doer, and then, well, you can you know, finish it off or whatever. And that way, if things really go bizarre, I know that everybody's taken it and that reset failed, and then I can go in and have significant evidence and enough people behind me to say those didn't match the form and those questions are undoable, and we can do amazing things with database. So that's the theory.
Cool.
Okay, any other questions that people can think of? One of the things that I really want to go over, and I want to make this very abundantly clearly clear, iOS is loaded from Flash, iOS is loaded from Flash, iOS is loaded from Flash, iOS is loaded from Flash. Everybody, in Chapter 11, iOS is loaded from Flash. It is not loaded from NVRAM, because there's usually only 32K or 64K of it. Unless you've got a ghetto network set up, it's not TFTP'd onto your router either. The iOS is loaded from Flash, usually into RAM so that it can run faster, but it is loaded from Flash. This is a free set of points in the final. So, I think I've made my point, but iOS is loaded from Flash.
Is the content, from your experience, Kerry, is it pretty well distributed, I guess I want to say, from across the different modules, or... I'm just curious if you can tell us if certain content is focused more heavily in the final exam for our own review that we do between now and then.
There isn't a lot of Chapter 1 stuff in the exam, because there wasn't actually a module for Chapter 1. But you will generally get two or three questions from each module as you go through the course. So there's going to be a question... There's going to be about two or three questions on subnetting. There's going to be two or three questions on the transport layer, the network layer, the data link layer. There's a couple of questions on at what point will the MAC address be what, if we look at this picture of four routers in a topology. If the packet is sent from here to here and we've got the following router configurations, what will... why does the packet stop here? Annoying stuff like that. So they're ones I tend to leave until the end, until you've got plenty of time to work those out. You'll be looking at various questions on iOS. For example, there was a question in the Module 11 exam that has a very similar counterpart in the final that says something along the lines of, which is the correct series of commands to set the passwords on a VTY line? So I can assure you that will be something like that will be in the final. There'll be a question that deals with the types of prompts that you're likely to see. Router number, router IF number, router config number, those sorts of things. Router line number. There will be questions on... there'll be a couple of trace route questions and things. And there is a question that shows IP config output and asks you a question on it. The pass mark is 75%. You get... I'm not sure whether they've updated. I think you get two shots at the final. If something incredible goes bad, however, we can talk to database and we can get extenuating circumstances and you get to take another shot at it. Or we shift it into the next class and all of your grades go with it and then you retake the final in the next class. So, and yes, have things gone horrendously wrong in the final before? Most definitely yes. They changed the forms a week before we were all going to sit the finals.
By the really? Forms, do you mean the diagrams, or?
Yep.
Fantastic. So you could spend time doing diagram descriptions only to find out that they're all wrong, along with the rest of us.
Probably what is actually going to happen is... I am going to enroll myself in the class and I am actually going to sit the finals and make sure that the diagram descriptions match up. There's not a lot of warning. Yeah, I thought so. I'd really rather be belting my head against a brick wall, but what do you do? So yeah, I'll be looking through and making sure that they all match up and then that way when you guys go through, there is a relatively high probability that you'll get through without too many problems.
And no calculators.
Ian lets us use the ones for adding up. He will actually sort of look the other way if you're using it for adding numbers together and stuff. But he tends to get a bit cranky if you're doing your decimal to binary conversion.
I was using an abacus today when I took the exam on subnetting.
Yes, John.
I just had a couple of things. One is with trace route, as the numbers, the times go down, the various responses that you get back, is that a cumulative time? So if the first one you get 46 millisecond and the second one you get 50, is that 50 the whole thing from, say, both hops, or is it's not just from hop one to hop two, it's the whole total, right? When you do the, when you see the trace route output and you get the length of time for each, with each result.
Yes, the times of a trace route are the round trip time between you and each of the hops, which, unless something really, really weird is going on your network, should generally increase the further away you go. If they are large numbers and then become small numbers, you can assume that your network was under a reasonable amount of load and then that load went away. So if you've got one that's like, you know, the first hop's 300 milliseconds and the next hop is 200 milliseconds, you can assume that when you were actually testing the 300 millisecond hop, your network was under load and now it's not. So, yes, the numbers should get bigger the further away you go, and they are the cumulative round-trip time between you and the hop that the packet is coming back from. So, basically, what happens is you send out the port, you send out the packet with the TTL one lower than it needs to be to an unused UDP port, and you time how long it takes for a time exceeded message to be returned, and that is what the numbers are going to be that come back to you.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And the other point was, I'm not sure if anybody else had noticed but on some of the exams, when there's no... some of these exam questions must have diagrams for the actual... or pictures for the answers or something, because there's radio buttons with no actual labels, and I found that at least I'm using JAWS 10 and it doesn't seem to read those at all, that there's no... doesn't indicate the options, but NVDA reads radio button. There's no label, but it does indicate the radio button. So if the description says this is 1, this is 2, this is 3, then you can pick the, say, the second radio button or whatever the choice is.
Yeah, I saw that, and there was a exam diagram with the choices for the radio buttons, and you had to just look at it. I think that was for cables, like pictures of cables. I remember that question.
Yeah, one was connectors, and the other was for ports on the back of the router. They were both connections.
Oh,
and
yeah, it
images,
was connectors on
but
cables.
But they weren't described.
Whoa, I think I'm back.
Yeah.
Just got disconnected from Ventrilo. But I managed to get all of John's question. Hang on. I think I've got to start recording again.
I have it recording.
Oh, okay, cool. I'll just get your VRF, that'll be easier. I know there was that problem with Module 8. There were some questions that just had radio buttons and not descriptions, but as far as I recollect, we put up a diagram descriptions for 8, which fixed that one. And then the other ones were non-scored, non-counted questions, if my memory serves.
Other one was Module 11. It was the router ports. It was the same situation, but the descriptions were there. And while you were disconnected, John pointed out you can count the radio buttons with the screen reader, and that with the description will get you through.
Absolutely. And that is standard survey-taking flash practice. If you're earning monies from online surveys, you get very good at counting the radio buttons. Have we mentioned it to Cisco? Yes. Did we mention it to Cisco? Yes. Did we claim it was an accessibility problem? Yes. Did they do anything about it? No. So, yes, we know. Believe it or not, as the amount of money to the Learning Institute at Cisco has been reduced given economic bad times, so has the budget set aside for accessibility. Familiar to anyone?
No, not at all.
Yeah, so your remedy for that is to count down the number of radio buttons and say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We wish there was a better way, but we have no control over the content in the exam testing system.
Yeah, I guess the main point I had was and maybe this is fixed in other later versions of JAWS, I haven't tried it, but the first time I ran across it, it kind of threw me for a loop, because JAWS didn't indicate the radio buttons, but then when I used NVDA, then it showed up, but I haven't tried it with 11 and higher of JAWS, so maybe that's been fixed.
Yeah, it has, actually. As previously discussed, JAWS and Internet Explorer and Freedom and stuff do some weird things on the web to make things happen. And as the versions of JAWS get higher, different and interesting and bizarre and strange things show up in your web browser that you were never able to see before. Case in point, certain Flash movies and stuff. And I believe it was 11 that you could start seeing those radio buttons because it's some funny way they're rendered up on the page, and that's why they don't show up by default.
Fair enough.
I don't know whether anybody remembers back to around JAWS 7.1, JAWS 8. It actually used to lose its place on your web page, or every time you used to Alt-Tab, and you would be, 10 questions down, and you'd Alt-Tab to look at some diagram descriptions, and when you'd come back, you'd be back at the top of the document again. And the remedy for that was to set a temporary place marker, but that was really inconvenient. And Firefox sometimes does that for no good reason, which is why we primarily recommend people use Internet Explorer to take the exams, unless they've got a very good reason not to.
You mentioned Kerry skipping some of the more challenging questions to get through, and I certainly would agree with that strategy, but I'm curious, since the final's substantially longer than the others, does the system provide any easy mechanism for getting back to the ones that you skipped, or do you have to go back and scroll through every single question to find the ones you didn't answer?
You do have to go through each question to find the ones you didn't answer, but my method of doing that is to press R to jump to the next radio button and quickly cycle through the radio buttons, and if you've got a set of radio buttons where you haven't set an option, then you can pretty much assume... Yes, Grace, I'm getting to that. It will actually, if you have got none of the radio buttons checked, You can see that it will also tell you if you haven't answered certain questions at the end of the quiz, but it doesn't tell you which ones you didn't answer.
It does.
Does it? Okay, Grace thinks it tells you which question numbers. I had trouble with that in the exploration, and the whole system blew up when I was trying to navigate around and stuff. They may have fixed that recently, but I would be inclined to look back down yourself. I tend to find that the system becomes exponentially more unstable the closer to that grade exam button you get.
That's been my experience as well, so good advice.
One idea I have is, since you already have the diagrams file open, you could write on at the bottom right the numbers of the questions when you decide to skip them, and then you would know which ones you had to answer, and then you could search for that question when you're going back to answer.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, that's not a bad idea at all. So you could put down the numbers of the questions that you hadn't answered if you were going to skip them and back to them, and that way you would have a list of the ones you're going to come back to. So there's another way of working around it. Officially,
Kevin should get you've a raise.
Got. Okay, I'll quadruple his payment. He's now being paid four times nothing. Now, you do get 3 hours to do the final. You probably don't need 3 hours to do the final. Maybe some people will need 3 hours to do the final, but my experience is that if you can get it over and done with in about an hour to an hour and a half, it will be easier on you and it will be far less stressful, and you won't be worrying yourself inside out about whether question 15 really does have the right answer or not on it. My other advice for you is, unless you are 1000% positive, do not go back and change your first answer, because there is a high probability that you will change it to the wrong one. That has been my experience with a lot of students that we've had going through the tests. They initially put the right answer in, and then they went back and changed it and found that the answer they changed it to wasn't the correct one. Okay, any other comments, stuff, before we go on to the basic review of the module and we try to cover the poignant bits?
Does the final certificate thing that we get have our final percentage or anything like that, or is it just a pass-fail?
You did the course, you passed, well done, and here's a signed letter from John Chambers.
Okay, awesome.
There are no numerical values on the certificate at all.
And as far as notes, it's fair game to use like a WordPad window or something, like a word processor to take to do notes for calculations and stuff, right? That should be fine, you know, for submitting calculations or things like that.
Oh yeah, that's fine. But if the WordPad document that you're using is not empty, then that's not fine. So obviously having empty notepad documents and writing paper and stuff is fine, and Ian even permits the use of a calculator for addition and stuff as well, generally speaking. The thing you've got to understand is that we cannot stop you all from cheating. There is no way for us to theoretically supervise you all and stop you from cheating. However, the practical upshot of that will be that you will get your Exploration 1 certificate, however you are most likely not to pass the CCENT. Now, I'm not inferring that anybody here would actually cheat, but I am sort of saying that we take as many safeguards as we can, but nothing is completely foolproof. In the Pearson View Centres, however, though, you will tend to find that you will have people supervising you. There are cameras, there are all sorts of things to make sure that you don't do anything that you shouldn't be doing.
When I took my CompTIA at the Pearson View Center, yeah, you're in a locked room. There's somebody watching you on a camera. You have like a scribe or whatever to interact with the testing computer. You can't take anything electronic in there with you. You can't take your wallet in there with you. Basically, yeah, you get stripped down and leave all your non-essential clothing and such in a locker. And if you need to pee or otherwise relieve yourself or whatever, they have to escort you. And yeah.
So that's essentially how that works. Now, all right. Shall we do a quick whiz through of where are you off to? Shall we do a quick whiz through of course content and remind you of what things happened in the different chapters? Now, if you are revising this, and some of you will, may I recommend the chapter summaries? If you read the chapter summary of a particular module and go, huh? It might be time to go back and read the section at which you went, huh? Because that means that you don't remember something that was brought up in that summary. Does it also matter that I tell you all that you have all successfully passed the practical component of the course? There's a mark in the gradebook where we put in a mark for practical participation, and if nothing else goes right, you've all passed that bit. So that's probably something to be happy about.
Enter the labs.
When are they drawing for the... Sorry.
Oh, that's a good question. How are we going to do the drawing, actually? Are we... Oh, there's a thing called the hat, apparently, that might be able to do it. Alright, we might do it that way. Oh, and it makes stupid noises, which is very important. I think for a blind class, we've got to have an app that makes stupid noises. So we'll try and organise some way of you guys hearing the stupid noises that the hat... should we draw it next week? Does everybody want us to draw it next week after the final, perhaps?
That'd be cool.
All right.
Alrighty. Yeah, so we're going to try and draw it next week. Well, see, we can't use that. Is this an iPhone app?
No.
You're going to have to show me because you're not going to be in next week. I'm going to have to do it. You'll be at work. Yeah, they take the finals first.
That's definitely a reason to show up to the exam, if nothing else, to hopefully win a Microtech router. I know I wouldn't mind having one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the idea. The labs and stuff will be marked and returned hopefully by next week. I don't intend having a life this week/weekend, and you guys will get your labs marked and returned. And if there is something wrong with them at this point, I will probably talk to you about it, and then we'll talk about it and we'll sort it out, and we'll make sure that you understand the content, and then we can actually put the correct marks into the gradebook, so you're not going to miss out on passing the lab component. Alrighty, shall we go on to the revision stuff and do a little bit of that and make sure everybody remembers the different bits of the course?
Yep.
Alrighty. Networks. Everything is networked. Everything is tied together. Think about networks such as the television network, the radio network, the networks of your people, Facebook, social networks, the internet. The internet being big network being everybody on the internet. All of the world's connected together with all different computers. TCP/IP connects the world together. That's network. Voice data video convergence. Usually we used to run all this stuff on separate infrastructure. We now run all of the voice video and data over the network. And we look at things such as radio stations and stuff that now connect sites together with the internet rather than using other network technologies. Protocols and rules for communications. How, when, and what to send. How do you send it? How fast do you send it? What format do you send it? How do you break it down? What sort of error detection, error correction, retransmission exists? Don't forget to type your name into chat if you've got a question, because this is going to go through very quickly. And I will come back and ask whatever question it is that you've answered, ask whatever question you've got. Messages are usually segmented down into various sizes, because if you don't segment messages down into various sizes, the message can monopolize the network. There is a difference between a circuit switch network and a packet switch set network. A circuit switch network is a network that establishes a circuit whenever communication is required, and it disconnects the circuit when the communication is finished. A packet switching network is where data is broken down into packet-sized sections. These packets are then sent over various mediums, and they can be sent over various routes. A packet can follow one of many routes, and this is done for fault tolerance, reliability, and those sorts of reasons. The names of PDUs at the various layers of the OSI reference model. Before we go there, we have seven layers of the OSI reference model. We have the physical layer, we have the data link layer, we have the network layer, we have the transport layer, we have the session layer, we have the presentation layer, we have the application layer. Okay, any questions so far?
How many breaths physical layer was that?
That's all right. Well, I'm trying to get through a lot of material here, guys. You guys want a revision lecture? This is what you're going to get. This is what I spent, 17 weeks teaching you guys. Here we go.
Oh, no, I'm impressed. I just wondered if it was two or three breaths.
Okay, the physical networking layer concerns itself with cables. It contains itself with connectors. It concerns itself with pinouts. These are the actual physical interconnects that connect the different things together. The data link layer, it also concerns itself with voltages and also light pulses, wavelengths, those sorts of things. The data link layer concerns itself with framing. It concerns itself with bits. It concerns itself with error detection, and in some cases error correction if it's a low level error correction, but we'll come back to that in a minute. And it concerns itself with frames. So if we are looking at the PDU for the physical layer, we are looking at bits. If we are looking at the physical data unit, protocol data unit for the data link layer, we are looking at frames. Now we move up to the network layer. At the data link layer, we have addresses that are specific to cards or specific to nodes, such as the MAC address, media access control, 48 bits long, assigned uniquely to each network card. 24 bits are the organizational unique identifier, and 24 bits are a serial number specific to the card assigned by the manufacturer. The network layer concerns itself with logical addressing, which is often set either by things on the network or by the administrators, and you're concerning yourself with things such as IP addressing and those sorts of things at the network layer. Yes? Sorry, I thought I heard someone key up, so I was just pausing to... Okay, the network layer is basically concerns itself with getting packets between hosts, and we're looking at logical addressing, we're looking at routing, we're looking at subnetting, we're looking at those sorts of processes at that level. The transport layer concerns itself with reliable transport of information. So if we're talking about TCP/IP, TCP operates at the transport layer. It handles the packet retries, the packet retransmissions, those sorts of things. And it also handles, as I said, end-to-end reliable data transport. The session layer does opening and closing of sessions, and it does managing whether a communications channel is open or not. So you can look at things like the TCP connection between two hosts being open as being an open session. You can also think of sessions as things like phone calls. The presentation layer concerns itself with character set conversion. It also concerns itself with things like encryption and data compression. And then the application layer concerns itself with the communication between the applications and the rest of the OSI reference model. A packet goes from the application layer down to the application, it then goes down to the presentation layer. After it goes down from the presentation layer, it goes down to the session layer. Once it's gone to the session layer, it goes down to the transport layer, and then down to the network layer, then down to the data link layer, down to the physical layer, across the physical layer, up to the data link layer, up to the network layer, up to the transport layer, up to the session layer, up to the presentation layer, up to the application layer. Any questions?
PDUs?
Protocol data units, and they are the names of the different bits of stuff that is shoved down the channel at the various levels of the OSI reference model. Bits, frames, segments, packets, and data.
That's what I was after. So above packets at the network layer, everything else is just data.
Yes. Now you have segments at the transport layer. So you have bits, frames, packets, segments, data.
Excellent. forgot all about segment.
Ah, and they do come into play when you're dealing with TCP/IP and you're dealing with things like window size and all that sort of stuff, and they are certainly segments of data which are actually bigger than packets, dealing with your window sizing and all those sorts of things.
Great, it was too many weeks ago.
Yeah, well, this is Trobe supposed to jog your memory and remind you of a few of the things I said, so... So that's your OSI reference model. Then we tie the TCP/IP model, which has four layers. It has network access, it has network, it has transport, it has application. The network access layer is layers 1 and 2 of the OSI reference model. The network layer corresponds to the network layer, the transport corresponds to the transport, and the application layer corresponds to the OSI layers 5, 6, and 7. I do not believe there are any questions on that in the test, but I will cover it anyway. Well, I just did. Any queries, questions in any of the stuff that I've covered so far?
No, alrighty. But thank goodness now, it's not as frightening as it was 17 weeks ago.
Well, that's the idea. I mean, if something really does trip you up, we'll go back over and talk about it. But when you first do this stuff, it's sort of like, well, what's all this strange stuff? And hopefully by now it will be somewhat less strange and you'll be a little more familiar with it and we've talked about it and it will be less of a problem. Okay. The other things we covered was we did a huge 3 or 4 week section on... network addressing and TCP/IP and subnetting. Can anybody tell me how many bits are in an IPv4 address?
32.
We have one person with 32. Anyone else disagree with that? Everybody happy with 32?
I'll go with it.
Okay, IPv4 addresses are 32 bits long. They're broken into two sections. They are broken into the network portion. They are broken into the host portion. The network portion and host portion are separated by the subnet mask. The subnet mask is a quantity that has a number of binary ones on the left-hand side and a number of binary zeros on the right-hand side. The number of binary runs tells you how many network bits you have, and the number of binary zeros tells you how many host bits you have. Binary being a base 2 number system with 1 and 0. Basically you have powers of 2, from 2 to the power of 0 up to, in our case, 2 to the power of 31, and you have 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, if you're only working in byte quantities. You take the number and you subtract the largest power of 2 from the number, write down a 1. Then if you can subtract the next largest power of 2, you write down another 1, otherwise you write down another 0. You keep subtracting powers of 2 in decreasing values until you have no remainder, and the string of 1s and 0s is the binary conversion of the decimal number you fed in at the start. If you wish to convert a number from binary back to decimal, you find the powers of 2 that are in the positions where there are 1s in your binary number, add those together, and you will get the decimal number. Everybody remember all of that stuff?
Yep.
Okie dokie. When you are doing subnetting, you need to look at how many IP addresses you need for various applications, how many IP addresses do you need on specific networks. The key to allocating IPv4 address space is to allocate the correct number of IP addresses for the correct number of hosts you've got due to IP shortage. There are 5 classes of networks, A, B, C, D, and E. A Class A network has 16.7 million addresses and a subnet mask of 255.0.0.0. Class B has 65,536 addresses and a subnet mask of 255.255.0.0. Class C has 256 addresses and has a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. D and E are not covered here. You can look those up on Wikipedia, but don't do it while they're protesting against SOPA or it won't work. If you look at the subnet mask, as I said previously, the number of bits that you allocate on the left-hand side of the subnet mask tell you how many bits are in the network portion, and the number of zeros on the right-hand side of the number of bits tell you how many are in the host portion. You can write network addresses out in what we call CIDR notation, which is classless inter-domain routing, which is an IP address followed by the number of bits in the network portion of the subnet mask. Always know that there are two addresses reserved on any IP subnet with all of the host bits set to zero. That is known as the network address and refers to the entire network. If all of the host bits are set to one, this is known as the broadcast address, and this is the other reserved address that you have on an IP network. Therefore, an IP subnet that has 256 addresses will have all of the host bits set to zero for network, all of the host bits set to one for broadcast, and have a usable number of 254 addresses. Any questions on all of that? Okay, we worked through various problems where we looked at various networks and how to break the various IP space down into various subnetted amounts. And we spoke about the fact that you have network bits, you have the number of bits that you're going to borrow to make the subnets, and then you have the host bits. The number of bits that you're borrowing to make the subnet bits sort of say how many subnets you can actually have. So if you borrow one bit, you can have two subnets because that bit can be set to 0 and 1. If you borrow two bits, you can have four subnets because those bits can be set to 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, or 1, 1. Therefore, the number of bits you borrow to make subnets sets the number of subnets that you've got. The more bits you borrow, the higher the number of subnets, yet the smaller the amount of subnets created. Everybody cool with that stuff? Everybody remember me talking about that stuff?
Yep.
Yep.
Alrighty. So that is basically your whirlwind thing to do with subnetting. And they will ask you a couple of subnetting questions in the exam. For example, which is a valid subnet mask for this subnet based on the information that's given, or is this machine on the same subnet as this other machine? And as a result of that, can you route to it without setting a default gateway? Yep.
Busy builders.
Yes, we all remember busy builders. You may wish to review the answers that you gave to that exercise before you do the final, because it will probably give you a good reminder of how you subnetted all this stuff, and it may make some sort of sense to you if you read it back. So that would be another revision tip I would suggest. Okay, we also talked about port numbers, and a port number being the way of differentiating which service is running on a host. It was a way of multiplexing multiple services onto one IP address, so we talked about common port numbers. They don't ask you common port numbers in exploration like they do in IT Essentials. So we looked at things like SSH being on port 22, Telnet being on port 23, SMTP on 25, FTP on 21 and 20 for the data connection, or some high number port if you're doing passive, and we talked about all of that sort of stuff. We talked about that ports under 1024 had to have administrative privilege to be allocated and are usually assigned to well-known server services. Ports above 1024 can be allocated by non-privileged processes and are used by things that don't generally have assigned port numbers assigned to them. Remember, we talked about a socket being the combination of a source IP source port and destination IP destination port. Each connection through a TCP/IP network can be identified uniquely by its socket. That is a tuplet of source IP source port destination IP destination port. Does everybody remember that stuff? I'm pretty sure I mentioned it at some point.
Yep.
Cheerio, Squishy. Have a good day. Grace is off to work. Okie dokie. We also spoke about network address translation, which is the procedure of hiding a lot of private IP addresses behind one public address, and we talked about the fact that the network address translator maintained a table of currently active sockets, and it would do translation of the IP addresses and ports between the internal and external machines. Sorry, Grace? Okay. We also had a bit of a talk briefly about how if you're torrenting on a really crummy router, you can overload the socket table and your router will fall over and crash, and we had some discussions on those sorts of things in the lectures that preceded this one. We also dealt with netstat. If you don't remember netstat, crack open a command prompt before next week, run a netstat-n, a netstat-a, and a netstat-an, potentially redirecting it into a text file, and make sure you understand some of the outputs so that when they ask you commands and stuff on netstat in the test, you will be familiar with the output format. The other thing you've got to be aware of is the difference between various networking devices. So we're talking about hubs, routers, switches, bridges, etc. Remember we spoke about a hub being a device that took a signal in one port and reflected it out to all other ports in the hub, also known as a multiport repeater. A repeater is a device that repeats and regenerates a signal, but it does it in the analog domain. It doesn't tend to do it in the digital domain. We then talked about a switch, which was a device that would micro-segment the network into multiple micro-segments. It maintained a forwarding table in content address memory that allowed the switch to learn which MAC addresses existed on which ports of the switch, and that packets were only forwarded to the ports that actually needed to see the packets, except for the case of broadcasts, which were forwarded to all packets. Everybody remember that stuff?
Yeah, and that was when collision domains came in on the switch ports?
Yes, and I think there is a question on collision domains. There's one question in the final about how many collision domains in the following network. So, hubs do not create collision domains. Repeaters do not create collision domains. Switches and routers segment the network into multiple collision domains. That is what you need to know to answer that question. Remember we spoke about carrier sense multiple access with collision detection, CSMACD. This is what makes collision domains important. How many machines or how many network cards are vying for contention of the media? The higher the contention for the media, the more likely you're going to see collisions, and in some cases you'll see late collisions, which is where a collision occurs after the first 64 bytes of the packet have been transmitted, and those late collisions are very difficult to detect and can result in degraded performance with data corruption. Most modern networks don't suffer from that too much, however, because we tend to use switches, and that definitely limits the size of collision domains.
Versus interfaces on a router that's creating broadcast domains, right?
Yes, a broadcast domain, you can also say that if you've got two broadcast domains, you've got two different collision domains. So a router basically breaks the infrastructure into multiple networks, and that's a broadcast domain, but the side effect of having it broken into two broadcast domains means that you also get two collision domains, because each broadcast domain is a collision domain unless it is subdivided based on the devices that are actually in that broadcast domain. Okay, any other general questions on that stuff so far? Now, in the later parts of the modules, we dealt with Cisco's IOS, which is the Internet Operating System that Cisco has been working on for years and years and charging lots of money for. It is the operating system that makes all of Cisco's routers work. It is the operating system that is designed to handle your routing and your switching and your network functions, and whatever functions you are running inside that IOS. There are all different sorts of IOS, and depending on which features your IOS has depends on which things your router can do, and some of them can do VPN and some of them can't, some of them can do voice over IP, some of them can't. It depends on the router and the IOS revision, and there is a bewildering set of tables and stuff on Cisco to help you figure out which IOS you need for your router before you hand over your hard-earned money. IOS is normally, there is a backup copy of IOS usually stored in ROM. This is usually an old version of IOS that is used to bootstrap the router in case of the flash or the NVRAM being corrupted. Then, generally speaking, the newer version of IOS is loaded from flash into memory. where it is executed inside the router, because RAM is much faster than flash, generally speaking. NVRAM contains the configuration of the router, which is a list of text commands that will allow you to see how the router is configured. Remember the commands: show running config, show startup config. The difference between showing running config and showing startup config is startup config will show you the contents of the configuration of the router after it has been powered on. Show running config will show you the configuration with the changes that you have made in the current boot session. Note to save the running config to the startup config, you need to copy running-config startup-config. There is a question like in Module 11 where it says what are the ways in which the administrator can find out the configuration of the router that you have turned on. So make sure you know about show running config, show startup config. I spent an hour of my life making sure that the remote bundle was functional for you all for the holidays. So if you have questions, log in and use it. The other thing you will need to be familiar with are the various router prompts. If you have a greater than in your router prompt, you are in user exec mode. This is a mode with very limited functionality where you cannot show or change the router configuration. You can, however, do pings and trace routes and a number of limited commands. If the prompt shows a hash mark similar to the hash mark in the Linux super user prompt, you are in privileged exec mode. Once you are in privileged exec mode, there are another of other modes you can be in, such as router config number, which is global config mode, router IF number, which is interface configuration mode, router line number, which is line configuration mode, and router config router number, which is router configuration mode. You don't need to know all of those configuration modes, but you need to be familiar with the fact that there is something in parentheses after the host name of the router and before the hash mark, and that will tell you what sort of configuration mode you are in. Remember that if you're going to connect to a router based by using Telnet or SSH, you will be connecting over VTY lines. A VTY line is a virtual terminal, and unless you set the password on a VTY line, you will be unable to Telnet or SSH into your router. Therefore, does anybody remember that question in Module 11 exam where you had to look and get the right commands? You were looking for one that said line VTY 0, password blah, secret blah, login. Does everybody remember that one? Has everyone seen that one? Or if you haven't done Module 11 exam, you will see that one.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing that one.
So that is how you set the password on your VTY lines, and that will allow you to Telnet or SSH into the router. You also need to go ahead, sorry.
That's the one in the sorry, my brain's gone. It's the curriculum, that's easy for me to say, where when they cover it, they always put setting the password for VTY 04, which is essentially a range, so it's setting it on all of them. Where
that
you can do
correct,
a single
yes.
one or a single one or a subset of the range, which I didn't find that to be clear in the module text, so you helped me to figure that out later in case that helps someone else.
Yeah, the first connection to a router will be allocated on VTY0, the second connection will be allocated on VTY1, so if you wish to only have one concurrent Telnet or SSH connection into the router, you can only set the password on VTY0 and it will only allow one connection at any given time. However, if you do a line VTY04, you will actually set the connection on all five VTY lines, and that will allow a maximum of five virtual terminal connections into the router. Also be aware that if you... my brain's gone off now. VTY04, 5 virtual terminal connections. There was some important thing I was going to say. Oh, the enable secret trumps the enable password. Remember, by default, the password is stored in clear text in the router unless you execute service password encryption, and that will apply a weak cryptography algorithm to the enable password. The enable secret, however, is encrypted with a much stronger password encryption algorithm and is not visible in the running config as the enable password is. And you should know that when the enable password and the enable secret are set, the secret takes precedence. There's also a thing that says you've got to get the enable secret class around the right way, and if you go enable secret password class, you will actually set the enable secret to password. I don't know whether they've still got that note in there, but you do need to understand that it's enable secret and what you want the enable secret to be set to, or enable password and what you want the password to be set to, and then if you put enable password secret in, you just end up confusing the students, so don't do it. Any questions on any of that? That's probably the extent of the review. If anybody has any specific areas they want me to focus on, that is a flying review of exploration. That is what you're meant to come out of it with. The ability to subnet, the ability to understand the router modes, the ability to log into a router and log out of a router. There may be a question on banner MOTD. Remember, the banner MOTD command is where you go banner MOTD, a delimiter character, the message of the day, and another delimiter character. They don't ask you exactly how to do that, but they do have a question on which command will change the message of the day on the router. And that's probably about it.
Is there anything on IPv6 at all?
Not a thing.
Excellent.
So what do you think about it? I've read some things that people are speculating that Cisco may do a refresh at some point and change all their exams and courses around. Have you heard that at all?
Yep. We expect it to happen every 1 to 2 years, and we go down to the pub and we get very, very, very drunk whenever it happens.
Because the last one was 1 to 2 years ago, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, and we had to redo all of the curriculum and all of the resources.
Is there anything about, anything to do with looking at routing tables?
No, you are... Or there might be one. I think there is one question at looking at a routing table and saying where a packet is going to go based on the routing table. So there is one routing table. I realize that wasn't what you wanted to hear, but it is true.
I'm not quite as scared of routing tables anymore. When you first covered them, I was terrified and confused and ready to go get super drunk at a pub myself, but I think I understand them a lot better now.
Oh, now the other thing I want to advertise, did I end up announcing the fact that the traffic control and bandwidth chat that we did last week is up on the server? Did I tell everybody about that? Did everybody see that at announce or something?
I did see that. And just as a subnote, if you do a part two and need someone to demo or show DDWRT versus Tomato, I am at your disposal, although it will be me having my screen reader read the screens and you explaining what it all is.
No, we're running part two on Friday, and I am actually retrofitting two routers, one with Tomato and one with WRT, and that should stop everybody from complaining, and they will all see the difference. So that's covered. But yes, if I need your assistance, I will let you know. So part two, everybody, of that chat is running on Friday, and I am announcing it when I have finished this revision lecture. And that will be running on Friday, where we actually go through and show you how to use the classifiers and how to use the various traffic control and quality of service in the different firmwares. And then we tell you you really should go out and buy a Mikrotik, but we'll show you anyway.
Or maybe we'll win one and then we won't have to buy one.
No, I wouldn't say a Cisco. Have you ever configured traffic shaping on a Cisco, Kevin? That's about as much fun as slamming your hand in the door.
Yeah, I taught myself how to do it.
It's several forms of evil.
It took a while. Yeah, I had to do it for a job.
So is the practice final, do we have to do that, or is it sort of an optional thing?
You don't have to do it, but you'd be pretty stupid not to. What better way to test your knowledge of the various sections than by doing the practice final, which doesn't count towards your mark?
No, I was just curious.
You don't have to do any of this. In fact, I don't even have to send you a certificate if you don't do any of this. You know, this is adult education. You don't have to do anything. But I would strongly recommend that the practice final be done, because it is a good way for you to be... you think you know everything until somebody asks you questions about it, and the practice final is a good way of triggering those neurons and you going, oh, I don't know 6.7.4 as well as I thought. So, no, you don't have to, but I'd really strongly recommend that you do the practice final.
So you can do the practice final twice like the other one?
Yes, you can. And as far as I know, the practice final is still currently active. Alrighty. Well, unless there's any other questions and queries, I think we're done. I should be right to run the finals next week at 9. There we go. I'm off auto key. So when you get to that, Corey, if you drop the VRF in my Dropbox, I will process it and put it up as final revision lecture.